Okay, we're here with Professor Bob Pucci. How you doing, Bob?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
The good professor teaches at SUNY Ulster.
Yes, that's right.
And what do you teach, journalism?
I teach journalism, film, speech, media and society, screenwriting, just about everything in the communications catalog.
Uh-huh. How did you get into that? As your specialty, I should say.
Well, as a specialty, well, I started out with in the theater, but I was always a writer. And so I worked for a local newspaper, now defunct, and I became a weatherman on local cable television, where I also produced different segments like the Hudson Valley Neighbor and an arts segment every week. And so I wound up getting a job teaching first at Ostos Community College, although I was an adjunct for a long time. And then I moved over to Ulster about 2001. And by then I had, accumulated various theater credits and journalism credits. And so there I was.
And then you became a professor. How do you become a professor?
Well, at a community college, it's usually a question of teaching and service to the college. At other institutions, it requires a publishing within your field. Community colleges tend to be teaching colleges, where the accent is on what you teach and how you teach it and how you serve the college more than publishing things.
Mm-hmm. Is that why the bigger universities all have their own publishing house?
Well, that, yeah.
To service the professors or aspiring professors?
Yes, and also, it gives them, a catalog. A lot of times, a professor will publish a textbook, and then that becomes the required text in that course. I would never do that. I believe in trade paperbacks for students.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you get into the specific fields that you teach?
Well, I think it came out of my experience working for the newspaper and working for the TV station, because if you're in theater, very often the adjunct teaching job that you get is public speaking. Because back then a lot of the departments were organized as speech and theater. When I applied for the job at Ulster, my credentials in journalism became important, because eventually I was going to coordinate the communication and media arts program there.
Hmm. So what, when you teach media, what encompasses that, or what is the, what makes up that class?
Okay, well, at one point I actually even taught videography, but now I teach a course called Media and Society, which is designed to understand how the mass media has changed and affected society, American society specifically, through the years. I teach a course in basic journalism, where not only do they do print, but they have to do a podcast, and they also have to do a brief or mini documentary. And I teach film classes, Art of the Film and World Cinema. And these classes are really designed to increase people's awareness of how movies are made, and also appreciate other cultures.
What kind of movies do you cover as a study?
Well, I usually start out with a film that sort of exemplifies the concept of structure and story, and then I do one that concentrates on cinematography, another one that concentrates on mise-en-scène, which is everything that you physically see, editing and sound, and then I usually go off and explore different genres and then different styles, such as, naturalistic, expressionistic, and surrealistic.
Do you have any specific go-to movies that you use as examples?
Well, I always use the 39 Steps, which is the Alfred Hitchcock movie from 1935, that I use that as the first film that they see, because it's kind of a nice action adventure film. It's in black and white, so I get them used to that concept. And it has a perfect story structure, so it's very easy to illustrate, you know, where the acts break and, you know, all of the basic screenplay elements that are in a film.
And what's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie? That's hard. I'm a big Stanley Kubrick fan, so I would think maybe one of his movies, and I really couldn't pick.
Well, full disclosure, I've been to Professor Pucci's house, and I know that there's a huge It's a Wonderful Life poster in your in your man cave there.
Yes, that was a gift from an actress that I worked with in a play. And, you know, it's nice. It's an unusual one because it's two-color instead of the three-color, which is more common. And I don't know, it might be of great value.
Well, you can't be a professor forever, you know.
No.
You have to trade those things in. What, but didn't you used to work on Broadway, too?
Well, I worked basically in the professional theater, but not on Broadway, off Broadway. And I worked as
and that's two blocks over?
Yeah. Well, I worked at this one little theater that was just a couple of doors down from Barnes & Noble on 18th Street near Fifth Avenue called the Medicine Show Theater Ensemble. And I did a number of designs for them, set designs, and directed a play for them. And we used to get people pulling up, and they were looking for this this restaurant, which had become very trendy, which was down in the next block, and we had to try and explain where it was. And there was another store that was on that block that was a good landmark. And it was the Revolutionary Bookstore. So we used to say that this trendy restaurant was slightly to the right of the Revolutionary Bookstore.
Understood. No connotations whatsoever.
Yeah.
So you teach film, and then you also teach journalism in SUNY Ulster.
Yes, and I don't know, it's an increasingly difficult task. When I started teaching it there, maybe 15, 16 years ago, I would say that most of the students read journalism and they experienced journalism on a regular basis. Now, I find it very rare that a student has actually read a newspaper. Or even understands the basic concepts of journalism, and it makes it a lot more difficult.
Does that reflect at all in the current state of journalism?
Well, it's getting there. I know that you know, budget cutbacks have pretty much eliminated the concept of the copy editor, which is why you'll find, you know, absurdly silly mistakes in even papers like the New York Times. There's no one there really sort of guarding the gate. Also makes it difficult for someone who wants to get into it because, you know, classically the people who became journalists very often, like I did, had a undergraduate degree in English. And basically you learn journalism by being on the staff of the newspaper and having an editor basically tell you, no, you can't do that, or yeah, no, you should do that, and yeah, no. And you know, basically correcting you and getting you to the point where you could pretty much write a story in your head, you know, without a typewriter or a word processor. And
then get it into the print without somebody reading it before the end user.
Yeah, well, and somebody would then edit it and get it in there. Although I learned that the best course of action was to learn how to self-edit, you know, to put something away for a little bit and then come at it like the first reader. and have questions and notice all the things that were usually left out. You know, people have this tendency to, yeah, I know what I'm saying, and they don't exactly express it. So when you self-edit, very often the copy is very clean, and when I've written for magazines, you know, I've noticed that what appears in print is pretty much what I submitted, you know, so it hasn't had to undergo a heavy edit.
Because you pre-edited it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, have you seen a drop-off in demand for the class itself?
Yes. Just in general, our program at one point, I think, had maybe 40 to 50 students enrolled in the concentration, which also includes a concentration in film, a concentration in public relations, and a kind of a general track. Now we're down to maybe about 10 or 12, and a couple of reasons for that. Obviously, we have competition. Dutchess Community College takes off a lot of students who live in the southern part of the county, and also they have much better facilities. And of course, those with good grades go to SUNY New Paltz.
I'd love to know how if their journalism classes have dropped off. I'm just curious what the younger people think as a potential career in terms of journalism. Do they see it as any future in it?
I think a lot of people in the communication and media arts concentration are looking for more lucrative jobs in, for example, public relations. Almost every entity that you can think of needs public relations. Particularly right now, they all need someone who could serve as a social media manager. So someone who has an idea of being a journalist is very much tempted by these other positions, which basically pay more and have a better future. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I can remember visiting the Poughkeepsie Journal and their editorial offices on the third floor. And as you stepped off the elevator, you basically saw a sea of desks and people at those desks. And you could hop onto one and basically walk from one side of the floor to the other on top of the desk, you know? Mm-hmm. Last time I visited there, you would have to be a broad jumper to get from desk to desk. Mm. You know, staff has been greatly reduced. The photography staff, I think, is non-existent. Maybe there's one person doing it. And this shrinkage, which is all across the, the industry, makes it very discouraging. For someone who wants to start out in it.
Right, so that's why I'm just uneducated hypothesis. I would think that the demand for those classes have dwindled, as you say, because the kids don't see as a viable career choice monetarily.
Right, right. Yeah. And, and there is that, not that kind of opportunity that there even was maybe 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Where there were also more local papers, they would take people on. They would pay them a little something for articles, and people felt that they were getting initiated into the business. And I think a lot of them, though, I asked them on the first day, what is the most important characteristic that a journalist has to have? And they say, oh, they have to be a good writer, or they say that they have to be a good observer and various things. And I say, no, that's not it. I said, it's curiosity. You have to know the what and why of everything. Mm-hmm. And that very often, students will have trouble coming up with ideas for stories. And I said, when I walk from my office on campus across two or three buildings to get to where I'm teaching the course, I can see about 15 stories as I walk, potential stories. And they're like, where do you see those stories? And then I sort of give them a list of things that they could write a story about. And they're like, they're sort of shocked by it because, you know, they didn't think of it. And of course, if you can't conceive of a story to write, you know, it's very unlikely that you're actually going to write it.
Well, that's, I guess, being a reporter, so to speak, curiosity was an age-old hallmark of the profession.
Oh, yeah.
For a good journalist.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I worked for a paper that's now defunct, the Evening News, that was a Newburgh Beacon publication, my editor, my local editor in Beacon, was a fellow named Will Lynch. And Will had very sort of big ears and big eyes. And he was always asking questions, and he was always kind of like, you know, hearing somebody say something and saying, ah, well, I have to investigate that, or I have to talk to so-and-so. I think there's a story there. And they used to say, in the business that someone had a nose for news, but it's really having big ears, you know, and listening and watching and just sort of noticing and saying to yourself, well, what's going on there? And why is it going on? And wanting to get the answers. And also liking to talk to people. You know, I have a lot of people, I guess, who like to write, but they're sort of hermits. You know, they would like to, you know, stay at their house and be journalists. And I say, well, no, you can't do that. I mean, you can send people emails, questions and such, and you can call them up on the telephone. And they're like, what? Use the telephone to actually make a telephone call? No, they don't do that. But no, you have to see people. You have to see them in their environment, preferably. You know, where they live, because, you know, their objects and the things around them tell you things about them, prompt questions and so on and so forth. And a lot of them don't want to do that thing. You know, they don't want to talk to people. And I'm like, no. Journalists want to talk to people. And they say, well, I'm shy, I'm an introvert. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of introverted myself. I appear like an extrovert because I'll talk to people. But that's my professional persona. You know, that's part of my job. And if you think about it that way, even if you're a shy person, you're not your name, you're the reporter. So as the reporter, yeah, you can ask that question. As the reporter, yeah, you can talk to those people.
Mm-hmm. So even the employed journalists are under fire with the whole fake news and there has been some shoddy reporting out there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people just don't read newspapers or magazines like they used to.
Right. Well,
and people don't even watch, people who are in the field for these networks.
Right.
People hardly even watch the network news anymore.
Well, actually, I think the average age of the newspaper reader now also collects Social Security. And the average viewer of TV news actually is north of 50. So almost everyone under 50 is getting whatever news they care to get. And I think this is another important issue that they care to get. Comes from the internet. And when I say that they care to get, is that they have my students, and I think a lot of people sort of in that age bracket, have a lot of very refined ignorance or an avoidance of current events. I was teaching a class called Media Literacy, and in the first years of the class, I told the students at the end of a particular week, I was going to give them a current events quiz, something that I had every week in the seventh grade.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I stopped after a while because, you know, the best person got like maybe 3 out of 10. Mm. And then it was almost by accident. And it was the thing that had just happened the day before and it was enormous. You know, in other words, you couldn't avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd mentioned...
I remember in seventh grade that you would play that tape of the... It always stuck in my head, the Hindenburg, that guy doing the... Oh, the humanity.
Oh, the humanity.
Yes. That was part of, I don't know why, I guess journalism appreciate. I don't even remember what it was.
Well, I guess it was would have been, you know, back then, I guess it would have all been lumped together in the social studies, is
yes.
what they called it. But and they would give you a little taste of various things. I remember writing, I guess my first journalistic enterprise was, I think it was in sixth grade, there was a teacher strike. And we were asked to write a story about the teacher strike. And I wrote the story, and the teacher at first thought it was plagiarized because it sounded so much like a news story. And then she realized as she was reading it that, you know, it didn't correspond exactly to any particular article or broadcast. And so I was like, oh, well, how did you write this? And I said, well, you know, I listen to the news and I read the news and I watch the news, and you pick up the format, you pick up the language,
the template.
A template, and then you tell the story that way.
Well, she was probably a scab anyway.
No,
if the teachers run strike, who the hell was teaching?
Well, this was after the strike.
Oh, yeah, I see. Okay.
About the teacher strike.
Okay. Yeah. So you also teach speech.
Yes.
Now I'm interested in what encompasses that kind of a program.
Well, you know, I often start out with you know, this idea that many people have come up to me over the years. And I was not their teacher, but when I mentioned that I've taught public speaking, they usually chirp in and say that, well, that was the best course I had in college, or the most useful course I had in college. And I try to impress that upon my students, because very often the last time they were told to speak to a group was when they were in fourth grade and they were asked what they did on their summer vacation. And since then, they were basically lectured to, and maybe they were asked questions that they were supposed to answer with one word or a sentence. And I always think that this ability to be facile in your oral communication is a very important skill. I mean, you use it in job interviews, you use it in presentations, and I also stress the idea that public is something that you put in quotes, since most people will never, you know, get in front of like a stadium full of people and have to give an address. But we're talking about small, specific audiences, usually related to their work or their career. And I often point out that a lot of job interviews these days are done with a group of people. You know, you're sitting in a room with five or six people asking.
Sometimes on Zoom nowadays.
Yeah, and Zoom is like the new player in that.
Yeah. Well, it's still public speaking. I mean, you can still talk on the computer in front of eight or nine different people.
Right. I mean, and if they're looking at you, if their cameras are on, you are picking up the nonverbal cues that will let you know how you're doing. But if you're just sort of speaking into the void, it gets very difficult, because mm-hmm. I champion the idea of speaking extemporaneously.
So when you're teaching speech to a student, you want to teach them what to look for in the recipient of what they're saying?
Oh yeah, because you see, when you speak extemporaneously, you have prepared what you're going to say, you have an outline, but you haven't prepared the exact words. Mm-hmm. And maybe you haven't thought of exactly how you're going to illustrate your point.
Sort of like this podcast.
Yeah.
Run on the fly.
Right. And so without that, and you see, you're asking me questions, and If you look at your audience, they're kind of asking you questions too, if they're not clear about something. And then you can explain it better. Mm-hmm. But if you're not picking up their cues, you know, like, are they getting your humor? Are they following? Are they nodding? You know, if not, and they're nodding off, what are you doing? You know, how can you change course? Mm-hmm. I had a professor in grad school. It was a course that was taught completely in French. And it was taught by this very distinguished scholar called Henri Pear. And Professor Pear would go on, he had such a melodious voice that he was sort of like lulling people into a kind of a soporific state. And he would notice this, and he would just throw in a phrase in English, and everybody would be, you know, they'd kind of wake up. And because you see, a good speaker knows, he's looking at the audience. Are they still? Are they still paying attention to
me? It's time to slam the chair on the floor.
Yeah, yes. You know, put your shoe on the podium.
Is debate part of this, any of these, like the journalism or speech or?
Well, I've tried to make debate part of a class like media literacy, have people sort of study an issue, take a side, and then see if they can, work it out in a debate. And it could be, I also tried it in an honors public speaking class. And, if it's not a tradition, I think, that is established in high school, it's very difficult to establish it in college students. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't really understand the nature of argument and having evidence and listening to what the other person is saying so that you can come up with a way of countering what they're saying.
Well, that's the thing. I think among the arts, like journalism or whatever is, you know, seem to be going by the way of the candlestick maker in terms of occupations, the talent for public debate seems to be on the wane as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you go back and you look at, for example, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, even though they had a very very sort of strict way in which the debate proceeded, it was carried out at a much higher level than any of the more recent debates.
Well, sure. I mean, just watch the last Trump-Biden debate. And then watch the last Kennedy-Nixon debate. Right. There's two worlds. It's two different worlds.
Also,
or just listen to them without even watching.
Right. Also, news broadcast. One of the things that I play for my students is a newscast when Gerald Ford was president, and he gave a press conference. And the segment on the press conference today would be something like maybe 90 seconds long. And it might include one sound bite from whoever's the president. But they actually let Gerald Ford speak in paragraphs. And the segment lasted almost 5 minutes. Mm. And it was very thorough. You know, the sound bite has shrunk over time. Now I think the average is like 8 seconds. And it's almost like a perfunctory, hear the voice of, rather than listen to what the person is saying. Mm. And
one of the complaints I hear about Joe Biden is he doesn't talk in paragraphs, but maybe he doesn't need to nowadays.
Well, you know, I think he has a stuttering problem, and probably as a result, you know, his public speaking, may be somewhat, limited in terms of.
Well, it didn't hamper him when he was a senator, but
yeah,
I just think he doesn't need to speak in paragraphs, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I think that they will let him anyway. I mean, as far as the news is concerned, it comes down to. Then the people who handle politicians, tell them, well, don't really try to explain anything. Just say this. And because that's the sound bite. You know, I can, you know, if I can listen to an interview and I'm listening to it, good reporters, when you're interviewing someone for a videotape segment, they're taking notes. And when they're taking the note, when they hear something that's quotable, they write it down. And then when they're going through the tape or the file, they go, oh yeah, there it is, and they have the time code, and they use it. So you know, when we think about, I always think about like movie lines, iconic lines in movies, and how now it's almost like a screenwriter's job to figure out something that a character can say that will become iconic.
Yeah, be in the advertising for the movie.
Right, right. Yeah. But it'll also be something that sticks in people's memories.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, Ronald Reagan was a great public speaker, and Barack Obama was a great public speaker. But I think they were both masterful. But by comparison, you know, George Bush was a horrible public speaker. Donald Trump was horrible. Joe Biden's horrible.
Right.
Maybe it's not a prerequisite to be president to be a good public speaker.
Well, I knew it was. I mean, one of the questions that I pose in my final exam in media and society is that I have the students listen to one of FDR's fireside chats, and to research what they meant and how they affected, you know, the public. You know, they were reassuring. You know, it showed that the person at the top sort of cared for you, was, you know, was there for you, was willing to speak to you, to come into your kitchen and spend some time with you. And I thought that that was a very important effect of radio.
Yeah, well, it helped him that he came along at the time he did, when there was no TV, so to speak, and it was all on the radio. Which, as a man with, you know, in a wheelchair from polio, that was an advantage.
Oh yeah, but I also think that you know, what was the alternative was published speeches in newspapers, and without the sound of the voice, without the tone, without the idea of somebody speaking to you. Because, you know, what I say about radio and television, and also the internet, is that it's in your house with you. You know, you're hearing a voice. And
when you're home and comfortable.
Right. You're where you're comfortable. You're in your environment. And you're encountering, you know, whatever you see there. You know, and that makes it much more personal than something you might read.
Or even attending a speech in a public place. You know, you're sitting in a chair with 1,500 other people. Your reception of a speech might be different as if you were laying on the couch listening to it.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think film, for example, is greatly diminished by kind of like watching it on a small screen or watching it alone. I know that sometimes it takes a very sort of relaxed person to enjoy a comedy and laugh out loud if they're alone, you know. If they're in a group, as soon as someone starts to laugh, then that's like the permission switch is turned on and everybody laughs.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's a famous analysis. We were talking about the Kennedy-Nixon speech. It seems like a lot of people thought Nixon won the debate who listened to it on the radio, and Kennedy won a debate who listened to it on the or watched it on the television.
Right.
And that's probably a case in point of what you're trying to say in terms of perception of public speaking.
Yeah, I mean, what you can see of someone, you know, it makes you judge what they're saying because their nonverbal codes, their eye contact, how they gesture, their posture, and even just how they dress and their physical appearance will all always sort of convey a message that goes outside of whatever words.
Yeah, there was like an in-depth analysis of the dark suit Kennedy was wearing, the light suit Nixon was wearing. But it's to what you're saying, you know, you're paying, if you're listening to it, you're paying attention to actually what they're saying. But if you're watching it, you might be paying attention to the fly on Mike Pence's head or the sweat pouring down Nixon's face during the
debate.
Right. These are all things that will distract from what they're actually saying.
Well, it distracts from what they're saying, but it also modifies what they're saying. You know, if I always use this example in class, which is probably hard to do on the radio, but there was a commercial for a watch that was on TV a long time ago, and it's a graduation present, and the kid opens the box, and he has this expression on his face, and the other voice goes, "Is something wrong?" And he goes, "I was kind of hoping for a Longines."
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Remember that? Yeah. And it was just like, it's like you
serve somebody. You ungrateful bastard.
Right, exactly. you serve somebody food and you taste it and you're like, you make a face and is there something wrong? No, it's fine. It tastes great. See, people's words are not always definitive.
Unless you see the...
You see the rest of the package.
Right.
You know, so
which brings us back to the public speaking.
Right,
so, do you teach students to try and pick up on the nuances from the reactions?
Oh, definitely. But also, I have them kind of like I say, why don't you rehearse your speech in front of a mirror, so that you see what you look like when you're speaking? Are you sort of making eye contact with yourself?
You talking to me?
Yeah, right. Or are you kind of like, talking over someone's head? Because I know some people will, kind of like try to talk to the back wall. And, it's sort of like you want to wave and say, "Hey, I'm down here. Look at me." And don't try to avoid the audience. In fact, I suggest in a face-to-face environment that the speaker try to make eye contact with as many of the audience members as possible while they're speaking. So they really get the sense that you're talking to them and not at them.
Mm. And what about fear? Fear of public speaking? Do you have tricks of the trade to get around that? I know the old envision your audience in their underwear. Remember
I would think that's pretty scary. But
you might get in trouble teaching that now.
Yeah, well, I mentioned in classes as being kind of like the absurd ways in which people might deal with the idea of fear. But I asked them to break down their fear. And a lot of people wind up saying that it has something to do with being evaluated. People judging them, and judging them for their appearance, for their voice, that's one of the things that gives them fear. And that's why, there was always this other tip that they would give to a corporate type who had to give an address, and that was to have his wife sitting in the first row and just sort of give the speech to his wife, so he would be comfortable. And so I deal with the idea of, is the audience that strange? Are they that strange? Are they strangers absolutely? Or do you know them by type, by gender, by age? And can you relate to them?
Mm-hmm.
And if you can relate to them, then that's one part of the fear that should be, diminished, the fear of strangers. Then there's the anxiety of judgment. And I say, what is your task? What are you there to do? Because people who are concentrating on their objective rarely worry about how they look or how they sound or how other people are evaluating their performance while they're doing it. They're concentrating. As much as, I've played a lot of baseball, and as much as people are telling the pitcher to strike me out or for me to get a hit or for me to swing and miss, I'm not paying attention to them. Mm-hmm. I'm concentrating on when that ball comes in, whether I'm going to swing at it or not. And so I've helped a lot of people by saying, well, what are you up there to do? You're up there to demonstrate how to do something. You're up there sharing information about something. You're up there trying to persuade people to do something that is in their best interest. Mm-hmm. And if you concentrate on those things, you know, that fear that you have disappears. Mm-hmm. And people are not, they don't really care to some degree what you sound like. And I say to them, now you probably have some professors who are very good speakers. And they're very animated, and their voices are modulated and beautiful. But you have other teachers, and they have very soft voices, and they're very effective. And you're not thinking about how they sound, because you're being informed. And again, if you concentrate on your objective, then you can forget about all of those things. Mm-hmm. And you will be successful.
I think a lot of the fear is born in that obsolete, from the Twilight Zone. You're obsolete.
Oh.
All the people are judging you.
Right, right. Well, you know, I always say if you're doing a good job, that's how they're judging you. They're judging you at how you fulfill your objective. Uh-huh. So if you have to speak in an informative way for 5 minutes, and you get up there and you really have nothing to say, mm-hmm. and you're BSing the crowd, you know, expect eggs and rotten fruit.
Well, that's the thing. The number of times I had to speak publicly, what helped me was putting myself in the shoes of the audience. Like when I'm watching somebody give a public speech, I don't really care about what he's wearing or she's wearing or what their delivery system is. It's like you say, I care about what they're saying.
Right.
And if they say it right, I'll absorb it. And if they trip up, unless someone makes it like starts to do a complete meltdown, then it becomes interesting. It's sort of like watching a car wreck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, when there's like a real disaster, I think that, you know, the person who's participating in the disaster or creating it knows it. And if they're good, or if they have presence of mind, they take corrective action. Mm-hmm. And even to the point of just stopping. And saying, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared. And that's another aspect of what I call that relationship between right. the speaker and the audience, is a question of trust and honesty. Mm-hmm. In the Greek sense, it's ethos, a sense that people have a confidence and trust in the speaker. And I think that if you're being honest with the audience, when you make a mistake and you admit it, you gain their empathy. Mm-hmm. And then once you feel that an audience is with you, then you can really relax.
Right. Well, you never really relax, but I think, I don't know if you teach this or not, but I would think just repetition, like speaking in front of 15 people on a regular basis, say there's 15 people in your class.
Right.
I think that helps. You might melt down on your first time and get a little better the second time.
Oh yeah, well definitely. That's why one of the things that I'm going to be doing this summer is teaching the 7-week version of public speaking. And I always think that there's the people who take that are doing it for convenience, but I always say they're getting shortchanged because they don't get to experience growth over a full semester. I've seen, you know, quite a bit of transformation in some people from the first speeches that they give. And usually what I do is I start out with 4 or 5 speeches that are not graded. They're just practice. Mm-hmm. They have a very short practice, get comfortable kind of thing. And by the end, they're, you know, very proficient.
Do you also teach like speech analysis, like you take a famous speech and analyze why it worked and why it didn't?
Well, yeah, but usually what I do is...
Like the Gettysburg Address or Kennedy's inauguration speech or whatever?
No, I don't do that because, one, for two reasons. One is that usually they don't relate to the speech, you know, and they're just basically not listening. So what I concentrate on is sort of front loading it by giving them a very specific kind of outline, because my feeling about giving a speech is that it's really a logical sequence of questions related to the objective. And so what you're doing is you're answering that logical sequence of questions. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, your speech will be effective.
Yeah.
If you can do it with good rhetoric, which is very, very much a requirement of persuasive speech, perhaps not so much in other speeches, but then, you know, it's even better.
Yeah.
A lot of times, you know, I think Lincoln's Gettysburg Address being a great example was that he followed someone who spoke for almost 3 hours.
Yeah, that helped.
And, and that's a way of kind of like, you know, well, I could talk for 3 hours.
Well, the unsung heroes in that is the crowd. They stayed around for the 3 hour speech. And what the hell that guy was talking about, who knows?
And it was November.
I don't know if I would have stood there for 3 hours listening to this guy talk.
Right.
Even if I knew the president was going to talk next.
Right. Well, I understand the Lincoln-Douglas debates sometimes.
Well, that was in November, right? Excuse
yeah.
me. Was it?
Yeah.
So it couldn't have been perfect weather out
no,
there.
No. But Lincoln-Douglas debates were almost 6 hours long. And so, you know, Lincoln could have spoken, for 3 hours.
Mm.
But I think that, sometimes brevity and getting to the point and, making a speech more like poetry, because I always think of poetry as the most efficient way of expressing something, because each word has a value. And you don't want to waste words.
Well, that's what makes the Gettysburg Address so classical. It was such a classic is that every single word, you know, had real importance to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but Lincoln, you know, if you look at some of the address, did you ever read some of the addresses he did at Cooper Union?
Oh yes, those are pretty famous. The ones that
yeah, I mean, have you ever read any of them?
I did, but it's been a long time.
They're very well done.
Oh yeah,
and that was before he was president.
Oh yes, well so. he was a very articulate person.
Yeah.
Had a good sense of humor. I always say that always helps a public speaker is to have a good sense of humor.
Unfortunately, that's all you know. We were talking about like FDR. Only had the radio for the most part, maybe a newsreel, but for the most part only the radio. With Lincoln, all we have is the text.
Right, and
so you talk about nuance and deliveries, you have no idea what people say he had a high-pitched voice, but who the hell really knows?
Well, he probably had something like this, like a reedy voice.
Yes.
And, and when sometimes we think of someone having a high-pitched voice as maybe sounding like a woman or something, but actually the reedy voice that I'm doing right now is the preferred voice for radio.
Mm-hmm.
Because it cuts through.
Right, know? Right. Well, it doesn't fit his, you know, when you look at Lincoln statues and Lincoln portraits, you don't expect him to talk like that.
Right.
Have you ever heard George Patton speak?
Oh yes,
he had a high pitched voice.
Yes, he did. Well,
and
he was he's a Southerner. So
he definitely didn't fit what George C. Scott portrayed. So there you go.
Right, you know? Right.
But what is this May? We're coming up on May, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're in May, when this is being aired. You probably be wrapping up your semester as we speak.
Yes, I've got. At this point, I've got one more week of class and then final exams, and we're going to have a virtual commencement on the 15th. And their idea for it this year is to have everyone show up and to line the driveway of the college, and there's going to be a kind of a drive-by commencement where we have to you know, applaud the car.
Do you throw the diploma into the window?
Well, no, the president of the college will present their diploma shell, actually. You know, they just get a little book that they'll eventually mail their diploma to them.
Yes.
You know, he will make a presentation. Last year, he actually, for people who signed up for it, he actually went to their houses and hand-delivered the diplomas.
Wow. You
know, this year I'm envisioning it, if it's a nice day, it could be a good thing. Mm-hmm. A little on the comical side, because you're looking in the back of the car going like, well, who's that?
Just on me here.
Yeah.
Well, they had a high school graduation last year at the height of this whole, paranoia era, and I felt kind of bad. You know, all the seniors were in their cars, their own, or their parents were driving them down the street. It was unique, but it doesn't have the same oomph as a graduation ceremony.
No, I have to confess that, I've never been to one of my graduation ceremonies. And I can remember my undergraduate graduation. My brother also was going to graduate that year, and he actually even got me a gown, but he couldn't convince me to go because I was working, and I couldn't see going to that instead of making money at the summer job that I had. So I missed that, and I always said that my punishment for that is that I've now had to attend 30 some odd graduations in a gown.
There you go.
As a professor.
That's what they call karma, man.
Yeah.
You don't want to screw around with that.
So I've got my gown that's on the back of the door of my office at the college, and I guess I'll get to wear it at least one more time.